To be here, and I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me and for arranging this very nice conference. I'm going to talk about the problem of the connection between quantum entanglement and quantum criticality. In this, we have been doing quite a bit of work. I'm sure you have read all my papers. I will focus mostly on I have a number of collaborators, but particularly will focus on work that I've been doing with my student Benjamin Su, and with elaborating work I've done earlier on with Joel Moore. And some of that involves some recent also results we obtained with with Mike Mulligan and Una Kim. So there is some other work that if I have time I will cover, but I'm sure I won't. So let me go through the outline, the motivation first. We're going to talk about the relation between entanglement, entropy, and quantum phase transitions. And in particular, I'm going to go through a summary of what is known in one dimension. These are things that people have mentioned, but I will go quickly over that. Then I will discuss how this is realized in a class of quantum critical points in two space dimensions that have a dynamical exponent 2, which have a number of simplifying properties that allows for these computations to be done directly. And then I will mention the relation between these and topological phases. And if I have time, I'll talk about the quantum Hall effect and so on, but this I'm sure I won't have time. Okay. So the motivation is to some extent, I mean, I'm sure these are things that most of us here have thought about, is the question is what sort of, you can't even see what I'm writing here. So what are the correlations between the that entanglement entropy actually measures, and how to relate that perhaps to one day to something that can be measured in an experiment, okay? And this is actually an important question. There are some ideas that were proposed recently by Israel Klisch, who was somewhere, there he is, and Leonid Levitov back in 2009. We have recently written a paper with my student Sue and Eitan Grossfeld following up on that work, and there is some related work that Karin Leur discussed in her talk, which I missed, but this is not what I will talk about. So this is the only, for the moment, concrete proposal about measuring entanglement entropies in terms of some other observables. I'm not entirely sure if this is viable, and but we'll talk about that later, and I will not mention this in the talk again. So what do we know so far? So this is a quantity which is well understood in some sense in one dimension, but poorly understood outside one dimension, certainly for quantum critical systems. And one of the aspects of this which I find interesting, let me jump over this, is the following one. The way we understand the theory of quantum critical phenomena is essentially by analogy or by extension of the theory of classical critical phenomena. In other words, it's a theory associated that essentially describes the scaling properties of local fluctuating operators near a critical point, be thermal or quantum. And there are some important differences between the thermal case and the quantum case that have to do mainly with the dynamics of the problem. But aside from that, the description is essentially the same one. And one question that is natural to ask is there a property that in some sense more inherently quantum mechanical that in a sense will be have some typical characteristic properties near quantum phase transition, and the notion of entanglement and entanglement entropy arises naturally as a possible one. The disadvantage is the non-local character of this quantity, and therefore it doesn't have a natural home in the theory of critical phenomena, which is based on studying local operators. And so that's one of my main motivations for studying this problem. So to some extent, this is a case study on various systems of interest. And there isn't at the moment a general theory of that, at least not to my satisfaction. So I'm going to discuss a class of systems in two space dimensions that have a number of simplifying properties that allows these calculations to be done explicitly and to study the scaling of entanglement and so on. And we're going to see, let me first walk you through them. These systems essentially are generalizations of the quantum diamond model. These are systems with time reversal invariance. And originally, as a number of people already mentioned, were proposed as theories of quantum frustrated quantum magnets. Whether they are really theories of frustrated quantum magnets or not is a separate question. Afterwards, they acquired a life of their own. Originally, they were supposed to be theories of the so-called RVD state, of the resonating valence bond state in high TC. Never worked in high TC, but it's still, you know, good ideas never die. Okay? So the state is very simple. What you have is some configuration space. And in the case of the quantum dimer model, these are dimer coverings of the lattice. So the configurations are just the different dimer coverings, which you assume to be orthogonal and linearly independent. And this is the issue where the applicability of these to spin systems makes it problematic, since they are all not linearly independent. They are overcomplete in reality in that language. So there, you, in the quantum dimer model, you ignore that problem. You assume that these issues of overlaps are actually sufficiently small that they can be ignored. And then you say, well, let me take these configurations to be linearly independent and orthonormal. And then you simply construct, for example, a uniform linear superposition of them. Okay? So it's a very simple state. And in fact, there's a particular Hamiltonian that they will write down that was proposed by Roxer and Kivelson that has the nice property that this particular state or wave function is the exact wave function for a particular value of the parameters of that problem. So it's an example of reverse engineering where you have an exact Hamiltonian, an exact solution for an interesting solution for an exact Hamiltonian, which is different than having an exact solution for an interesting Hamiltonian. So what do we know about this state? This has been investigated by many people. On bipartite lattices, we know they describe, in general, quantum multicritical points at this particular fine-tuned place. When that happens, or in other words, when this transition for some reason is not first order, which in some cases can be, when it actually continues, it turns out that has dynamic critical exponent z equals 2 and has a massless deconfined spinons or holons or whatever you want to call them. For non-bipartite lattices, it turns out that these are actually Z2 deconfined topological spin liquids or topological liquids. Let me not use the term since the spins are long gone. Yeah, okay. And they have a fourfold degeneracy in the ground state on a torus. So this actually, this original model was proposed in 1988, and the triangular lattice calculation in detail was done in 1998, although some hints of this behavior was proposed by Reed and Sachdev in a good number of years before 1998. But for various reasons that have to do with prejudices of the field, namely, there was a very, how to say, strong dictum in high TC, you shall not leave the square lattice. And most people didn't want to look at the triangular lattice. And it took a long time to figure it out, not because the problem was inherently more difficult. So I have looked at this problem off and on over the years, and here I'm going to give you not the history of that, but sort of some basic ideas of that we developed with Mosley and Sondi, and with Paul Fendley and Eddie Ardon, and independently, but this was explored by Christopher Henry. So the quantum dimer model in a square lattice is much like a classical counterpart, is equivalent to a two-dimensional height model by a duality transformation. And the heights, essentially, on the dual lattice can be represented in terms of some scalar field that lives on the dual sides. And if you coarse grain them, they have to satisfy a property which I'm going to call compactification. Namely, they can be represented in terms of a phase field that has to be periodic with some period. And that period is determined by constraints that come from the lattice, namely that if you have a dimer on one bond, the other three bonds cannot be occupied by a dimer. And that essentially gives you essentially a constraint on the possible allowed configuration. So this actually determines a quantity that I'm going to call the compactification radius by analogy with the terminology in string theory. But the analogy is not arbitrary. It turns out that it's actually related to that. So there is a quantum version, a continuum version of this Hamiltonian that can be derived. And we all derived it in various ways, which we call the quantum Lifshitz model. And So the idea here is this is the kinetic energy term, is the usual pi squared over 2 here. Pi is the momentum conjugate to the height field phi. And instead of having the usual grad phi squared term, it has a Laplacian phi squared. So this is fine-tuned so that the grad phi squared term is actually set to 0. So this is on the verge of a transition from the uniform order state to a modulated state. Okay, and that's how this is defined. The origin of the term in this context, the quantum Lifshitz, is that if you think of this as a problem in 2 plus 1 dimensions in imaginary time, the associated imaginary time action turns out to be the lambda of free energy for the transition from a smectic to essentially to a modulated state at the Lifshitz point. And so that's why we use that terminology at that point. It has a nice property that the exact ground state wave function can be written down like in any problem associated. You see, this is a free field theory with some interesting properties, so this is a free field. It can be written down explicitly. Most of the times, the wave functions of Hamiltonians, even though they are free fields, they are complicated non-local objects. And when I went to kindergarten, I learned that I should not look at the wave function, because the wave function contains all kinds of crap, as we all say. But this particular one is interesting, much like the Laughlin wave function is. The Laughlin wave function has a magic property of being universal. This is not universal. It has a number of properties that actually made it quite simple. So one of them is that the wave function is local in the sense that it's an amplitude, it's a local weight associated with these height fields. And therefore, it looks formally like a Gibbs weight in classical statistical mechanics in the same dimension, which is actually a property that is already seen in the dimer model and its generalization. There is an arbitrary parameter here, k, that happens to be the same parameter that enters here. This is done in some normalization. And so if you compute the norm of the wave function, in other words, you square this, that's quantum mechanics, right? And they integrate over all configurations, then this actually looks precisely like the partition function of a classical, essentially of a boson in two dimensions Euclidean space. And this boson has some particular compactification radius r. Of course, if I change k, I change r by rescaling things. Okay, but it tells me, so knowing what this compactification radius is tells me what is the spectrum of allowed operators, and that's actually how we relate that to the discrete model. Okay? Yes?
All that derivative in Hamiltonian.
Yes.
Whether this, do you still have an exasoluble wave function or?
You cannot look for a free boson. You can always write down the wave function. It will be some horribly non-local thing.
Yeah, but the local one, I mean.
Here it's not sixth order. It's fourth.
Well, if you have a sixth order, eighth order, do you still have a?
No.
So only for this particular.
Well, it's only for this particular one, and only two and only in two dimensions. Okay. So it's very special. Okay. So the one thing that is important here is not only that this looks like a partition function, but also that the wave function is actually a scaling invariant quantity. And this is actually very peculiar. If you take a one-dimensional conformal field theory or one-dimensional critical system, the wave function scales. The ground state wave function is not a scaling invariant quantity. It's a partition function, the honest-to-God partition function that is scaling invariant, not the wave function. So this is very special about this type of system, that the wave function is a scaling invariant quantity. And I don't know of any other examples. That's what makes these problems particularly simple. So in this sense, you can think of them as being conformally invariant or scaling invariant wave functions, and that's what makes it intractable. So this can always be mapped to a two-dimensional Euclidean conformal field theory in this sense. So you can do this more generally. You can imagine some field. It doesn't have to be the field I have now. And you can associate with that field the Gibbs weight of some Euclidean two-dimensional free scale. In this case, it's a free scalar field, but you can do this more generally. In the particular case that we are studying here, the central charge of the associated two-dimensional CFT is 1. It's a very simple problem, and in fact, much of that is known. On the other hand, the dynamics of this is actually z equals 2. So if you want to look at the time dependence of the correlation functions, the time and space scale differently, and that actually comes from the form of the Hamiltonian. So it's not enough to have the wave function, you need to know what the Hamiltonian is. Okay. Sorry to bring the H word here. Most of us, we've been discussing wave functions, but sometimes you have to care about the Hamiltonian. So So if we match correlation functions with the known, so the other thing that is important is that the equal time correlation functions of the quantum problem therefore become the same as the equal time correlation functions of the associated classical problem. Notice that I have to square the amplitude, and so that changes the parameter there. But aside from that, once I set k to be r and to be 1, then you get the usual sort of dimer correlation functions here. But you can change these parameters by changing the dimer model, in fact. Okay? So for example, with Paul Findley and Eddie Ardon, we proposed a generalization of this where the wave function had weights that essentially were the weights of the Baxter model. You can play that game too. And then you get the generalization of this problem where you can vary. Now there's a marginal operator, so you can change the radius. You have a topological phase and so on. So there are many things you can do along play games of this type. And what I'd like to do here is to discuss essentially how the computation of entanglement entropy proceeds in this problem and what can you learn from these calculations. You can also do this for understanding non-abelian states with non-abelian statistics. For instance, with Paul Findley, we proposed this chromatic polynomial wave function, and which we still don't know whether it's topological or critical. And, people seem to oscillate, but it's an interesting problem, too. So let's talk about entanglement. Someone told me that I had to play some kind of, so Claudio Chamon told me that someone had to make a joke between the analogy between tango and entanglement. So here we go. It's not a good joke, but. All right, so let's talk about entanglement entropy. So I'm going to do something that other speakers have done. So imagine you have a system, a subsystem A, that is actually the result of a partition of a big system, which would be A union B. A and B do not intersect but share a common boundary. And you have a pure state in the entire system. And I'm going to write down the usual density matrix for that system. And from there, I can get the reduced density matrix by tracing over the rest of the system, say B. So there it is. That's the reduced density matrix. And the von Neumann entanglement entropy that you obtain, or you could compute other entropies if you like, is just simply by the usual formula, is minus a trace of rho log rho. And because the state that you started with is a pure state, this is symmetric. It doesn't care whether you're looking at A or B. Okay. So the question is, what is the scaling of behavior of quantum entanglement in extended systems? Namely, in, you know, say, imagine some general field theory, if you wish. And this problem was studied early on by a number of people, particularly Mark Svetnicki back in the early 90s, actually earlier on by Bombelli and collaborators. And what these people were interested in is in the problem of the explaining the area law of black hole entropy. And so the first thing they did was to look at the massive scalar field. They, for reasons that have to do with their background, they only looked in four dimensions, but you can put some dimensionality there. Not even in 26, but looking for. And so the entanglement entropy they discovered actually obeys an area law in the sense, in other words, that the entropy scales like the boundary of the region that is being observed, but the prefactor is non-universal. In other words, it depends on the UV cutoff that you have in the theory. Whereas in the case of the black hole entropy, this is determined by the Planck scale or something of that sort. And here, this, in some sense, is an arbitrary constant. So for this reason, even though there was quite a bit of interest in this in the early 90s in the high energy literature, this was quickly dropped. And then people, you know, went to do, you know, other things in string theory and eventually returned to this problem, but under different guise, as we saw today. So, so the point is that this non-universal term is actually the generic behavior, as you can see. In one dimension, things are simpler. So at least two of these are, by the way, the same one. Okay. And in one dimension, actually, this actually becomes a logarithm, as it was realized quite early on. This actually was proposed originally by Callan and Wilczek and other, Wilczek and other collaborators, and re-elaborated in around 2004 by Calabresi and Cardi, who showed that for a general conformal field theory, the entanglement entropy is the central charge divided by 3 times the log of the size of the region that is being observed. And the assumption here is that the region that is being observed is macroscopic, compared to the microscopic cutoff, but small compared to the overall size of the universe. Okay, so that order of limits is important. Plus finite terms. These finite terms in general are non-universal, because if I change the microscopic cutoff A, I will change the finite terms. But it turns out there are some universal pieces to the finite terms that were mentioned today by Ian in particular. Okay. So the same sort of scaling behavior actually has been found by Gil Raphael and Joel Moore. I think Gil probably discussed this. I don't know whether he's still here or he's gone. He just left, okay. In one-dimensional so-called infinite fixed points in random quantum chains. This is actually an interesting problem because this is a system that on the average is scale invariant, but if you wish representative or representative is not. So the actual meaning of the prefactor, which is universal, is not understood, at least not to me. So there isn't, even though it has a nice logarithmic scaling, what is the relation between the prefactor and other properties of that fixed point is an open question. On the other hand, away from the critical point, this actually will saturate at the correlation length up to factors of two, and then there are some finite terms as well. So the question is, what happens in higher dimensions? Clearly, you have to obey this property, and the reason is this actually comes primarily from the short distance behavior of the wave function. So you will expect in general, even if the system is critical, that you will have this area law and to be non-universal. The question is, if there is something universal, it will have to come in the dot, dot, dot that is sitting here. The only other case that before at least this work that I'm going to discuss here that was understood is a case of a topological phase in two dimensions, and this was studied by Kitaev and Preskill and independently by Levin and Wen. And they found that in addition to the so-called area law, which here means perimeter because you're in two dimensions, there is a universal constant term, which is negative, by the way. In this case, that's important. And it's related on topological invariance. So this is the log of the effective quantum dimension or things like that. It turns out that one can generalize this to more. So essentially, this is the entanglement entropy for a simply connected vision immersed in a big system. You can do more complicated things. If I have time, I will discuss that near the end of the talk. But aside from that, these were back to 2006 or so, these were the only results that were available. So with Joel Moore, we decided to look at these conformally variant wave functions and see what sort of scaling they obey. There is by now, by the way, a more recent result in phi to the fourth theory in the ON mode by Max Metlitsky and Subir Sachdev, and Max talked about this the day before I came, I think. So I'm not going to go over that. So what we do is here is we take a region, say, for instance, let me just simply take the region which is here, region A, with some particular size, and we split the system into two parts, if you wish, B and A, and then what we want to do is to compute the reduced density matrix of the system first, which is easy to do, so as I did before. And then you need to find an expression for the entanglement entropy, or rather for the trace of rho to the n. So let's call that, if you wish, the Rennie entropy formally. And so what you find when you do that is that that amounts to taking my configurations, you actually the square of those configurations, and forcing you have to replicate them because of the nth power here. So you have n copies of them. And you have to force the n copies to agree on the common boundary. So if you go through the construction, that's really what all you need to do. So formally, this amounts to a computation of a quantity that I'm going to call a partition function, essentially because it becomes essentially like the norm of these wave functions, where n of them are decoupled versus the case where they are forced to agree on a particular curve. And so you can imagine that you have n classical systems now, which are coupled by some local operator with coupling constant lambda, and you want to study two limits. One, when the coupling constant is zero, in which case they are decoupled. The other is when the coupling constant goes to infinity, in which case they are forced to agree. Okay? So you see that this actually smells to a problem in boundary conformal field theory, and I will show you down in the talk that, in fact, it is a problem in boundary CFT, and that actually gives you a general solution of this type of problem. But let me do first a simple thing first, which is what we did with Joel. So essentially what you have is n scalar fields, Now, one of them, essentially, one combination of them, essentially, has to be free, because nothing physical actually happens at this common boundary. This is an arbitrary, all you're doing is observing the system, you're not changing the state. So if you essentially shift all of the fields by an arbitrary amount, that has to be a symmetry of the problem. And therefore, the sort of speak center of mass, which is the average of these fields, is essentially not affected by this restriction, but the other n minus one combinations, in principle, are. So you go through a little algebra, and what you find is that you obtain the following identity, at least in, if you don't worry about compactification radii and so on. So what you find is that the trace of rho to the n, essentially the condition that all of them are coupled, there's always one partition function that decouples, which is for this free field that doesn't see the boundary. The other ones actually are forced to obey Dirichlet boundary conditions on the common boundary, so the relative fields, divided by the nth power of that, because these are free at that point. Therefore, at least within this simple-minded approach, what you find is a ratio of a partition function where this field essentially is supposed to have a Dirichlet boundary condition on the common boundary divided over the case where nothing happens, and you raise that to the nth minus one power. So notice that at least at this level of analysis, it appears that this is just simply power of n without any other n dependence. When we look at the effects of the compactification radius, we're going to see that there is a subleading effect associated with n. So you find here is that the entanglement entropy, for instance, if you take the log of that and you compute the usual entanglement entropy, is minus the log of the ratio of these two partition functions, if you wish. But the partition function here is for a partition function of the system where it has a part in A, a part in B, with a condition that is Dirichlet boundary condition, so they factorize. And so you have to divide this by the partition function of the union. So this is a general formula that you obtain, and it tells you that the entanglement entropy, if you want to call the negative of the log of the partition function a free energy, it reduces to computation of free energies in two-dimensional classical problems that you know how to compute. So in principle, something like this can be done, but you need to force, instead of Dirichlet boundary conditions, what you have is a more general condition that you need to force this to be in some conformally invariant boundary condition, in this case, that they are in the conformal block of identity. That turns out to be the general solution. Okay, so let me discuss a little bit the scaling of the free energy. This goes back to something that is called the Marcotte's law, which is he phrased the statement, can you hear the shape of a drum? So he was interested in the problem of spectral geometry. And in particular, he was calculating essentially determinants of operators, of elliptic operators on finite geometries, and in particular, computing the traces of them, determinants. So the free energy has a term that goes like the area of the system, like L square, like the perimeter. There are terms which are logarithmic, and they depend on the central charge in general. This is a generalization of the Marcotte's result by Cardi and Peschel. Marcotte studied the C equals 1 case, and there are terms of order 1. The quantity chi here is the Euler characteristic of the region, which, as you know, is 2 minus twice the number of handles minus the number of boundaries. The quantity you need to compute is the total change, in fact, because it's f of a plus f of b minus f of the union. So essentially, the term, the prefactor of the log, so the extensive term that goes like the area cancels from that. There is a term, certainly there is a perimeter term that survives, which is the non-universal so-called area term. That's always there. But the term that you get here is the change, involves essentially the change in the Euler characteristic, which is just this. Now, if you have a region and you simply subtract, you extract a piece from there, that doesn't change the Euler characteristic. Therefore, the logarithmic term disappears. Okay. So in principle, so in other words, if provided the surface that you have is like the boundary is smooth, that there are no corners, there are no logarithmic corrections in this case, at least not for these two-dimensional systems. Okay. And in a sense, this is for a topological reason, as you can see. Okay. So on the other hand, if you have corners, that's not true. There are additional contributions, which are logarithmic, that come from the corners, depends on, they depend on the opening angle and so on. These are similar to the computations of Wilson loops and things of that sort. I'm not going to discuss that. That's sort of a non-generic case. There are, on the other hand, terms of order one that survive, and those terms have to be scale invariant. So in principle, they can be pure numbers, or they can be functions of the aspect ratio of the various regions. And that depends on the geometry that you study. So in principle, there is an order one piece, universal piece, that it turns out to be related to this G function, this G quantity that Ian mentioned, that also appears in this calculation. So let me talk about first the general case. I just said this, and then we'll skip it. So with my student Ben Su, Mike Mulligan, and Una Kim, we looked at what are the finite terms and the universal finite terms. So it turns out that this depends on the topology of the problem, depends on the shape of the region, depends on whether the region is simply connected or not, and so on. So for the quantum Lipschitz class on a cylinder, assuming, so imagine you have a cylinder with parts A and B. Let's call LA is the length of the cylinder of A, and LB the cylinder of B, and little l essentially will be the circumference of the cylinder. So I'm going to assume that these two lengths are much bigger than the circumference, so this is like the thin cylinder limit, in a sense. In that case, it turns out that the finite term is just simply the log of the compactification radius R, which here is essentially a quantity that depends on K, R squared, and 2, but this is, it turns out to be the effective compactification radius. I'm going to rederive this in using boundary conformal field theory in a moment. So this is actually what you find using this formula. If you apply this for the quantum diamond mode, R is the square root of 2 in that case, it turns out. So the finite term is the log of root 2. And notice, and this is actually quite interesting, there is a nearby topological phase that has also a constant term to the entanglement entropy, but there is the negative, is minus log 2. So in fact, not only are different, they have even different signs. So these are order one contributions, but in general, they are different in the topological phase than the associated quantum critical point of this point. Okay. So you can do this in other geometries. For instance, suppose you take a geometry like this, and I think we saw that today in your talk. So you can take a torus, and you can slice a torus like that. In fact, if you take actually a torus and you drive a small circle here, in fact, it doesn't even know it's a torus. It doesn't care. But if you take a torus and you cut it in this particular form, then you end up with a factor of 2 simply because there are two surfaces, but the dependence on the radius is actually different. It's log r squared over 2. So in fact, it does depend on properties of the surface. If you do the same computation actually on the disk, and this actually comes from doing conformal mappings, in addition to this term that depends on the log of the compactification radius, there is another term that depends on the aspect ratio of the two regions and has this sort of log-log form. And this actually follows from doing, you can do this by explicit computation or by essentially a conformal mapping methods and so on. It depends only on R and the torus. For the same reason that when you compute the corrections to the Casimir effect, if you wish, on the torus, it depends only on the factors which go like 1 over n squared and so on. It's the same reason. But if you do this on a flat surface, then in fact you do get these additional terms that depend on the aspect ratio. I mean, look, it's a scaling invariant system, so in principle it could depend on the aspect ratio, and it does in this case, but it's non-generic. Okay. So if one actually were to compute this actually for essentially a system on a disk, one should expect, in general, contributions of this type. So for that reason, it's actually much better to do computations on a torus or on a cylinder that are simpler to analyze. In addition to that, you will need to extract, still the plain log term disappears, but there is a subleading term that essentially has this double log structure. Okay? So you can generalize this, as I said, to other wave functions constructed in the same manner. Imagine you now take some generic conformal field theory, let's say make it rational if you want, and have a Gibbs weight, which is just a local amplitude for that, and you construct your wave function that way. So for instance, you can take that to be the Ising model, or a quantum Lucas or a quantum or a net model for that matter. And what you're going to have is, in that case, is the associated two-dimensional RCFT is defined in terms of a set of primary fields with some OPE that depends on these coefficients. And these coefficients are related to a quantity known as the modular S matrix through the Berlinde formula, which is here. And what is important here is that if you were to compute the finite size corrections to these partition functions with fixed boundary conditions, in addition to these terms which are of order 1 over L that enter here, they also enter through these Affleck-Ludwig boundary entropies that are related to this precisely to the entries of the modular S matrix of the theory and to the coefficients M. So in principle, if you know, so these coefficients therefore are going to enter in the computation of the entanglement entropy of this problem. You can apply this formula to this particular case. You find the usual non-universal term plus a finite piece. And so if you do this on a cylinder, you end up with a finite piece that depends on a combination of these Affleck-Ludwig entropies that appear naturally. And so here, zero will mean that you have free boundary conditions and A, well, which ones depends on what boundary conditions I have. The analog of Dirichlet in general will be some fixed boundary condition, and the other case will be free. So in general, you're going to end up, for instance, for the case of the Ising wave function, so you can do that, you can postulate the problem, can play this game of I write down a wave function, then I find the Hamiltonian is local, I declare victory. So you can compute that, and you find that that number, for instance, that case is log 2. You can also use these relations for this chromatic polynomial Fibonacci wave function that we discussed before, and you end up with that number, which is kind of nice. not very. But as I said, okay, the flip side of this is that essentially you enjoy doing a lot of the simple calculations for scaling variant wave functions in 2D. These are very special fixed points that have lots of unstable directions, and generically the system becomes first order. And until essentially our calculations, not much was known about other cases, except now we have these nice calculations by Ignatovich, Fuertes, and Sachdev in phi to the fourth in the Lagrangian limit. They also find.
It's not in the Lagrangian.
It's epsilon expansion.
Well, okay. Most of the results are in the
epsilon. Interestingly enough, you also find the same relation. So there is a sort of a perimeter or area law term which is non universal plus a universal finite piece. What I don't understand, at least in this particular case, there is some structure in the wave function that tells me what this finite term should look like. In the other case, I don't really know how to interpret that in terms of the properties of phi to the fourth theory. And maybe you have some insight we can discuss later.
It's just a new universal quantity.
Right. Yeah. So this is an interesting question. So it seems that this is sort of the generic behavior, even though the particular numbers you get here do depend on the particular state. So let me talk about how to think about this problem as a boundary CFT. How much time do we have left?
You've got about 5 minutes.
Okay. Okay. So as I said, you can always write this down as a ratio of essentially two partition functions of this type. In one case, we have n copies of a partition function which are forced to agree on some common boundary, and the other case where they are decoupled. Okay. So in the particular case of the quantum Lipschitz model with compactification radius r, we're going to take a cylinder of total length L and circumference little l, is much like the geometry discussed before. I'm going to assume that they are both of the same size, more or less, so for simplicity. So each one has length L over 2, and they are both much bigger than the circumference of the cylinder. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go back to my geometry here. So let me do the cylinder. So now I'm going to have n copies of this, and they're going to be forced to agree on the common boundary there. I'm going to play a trick, which is very common in this field, which is to fold the left-hand side onto the right-hand side. So now we have two n cylinders, each of length L over 2, which are forced to agree on the common boundary here, have essentially the Dirichlet boundary conditions on the other end. So that can be done explicitly. So this problem is actually quite simple, and so now I'm going to keep track of the compactification radius carefully. It turns out that you can construct essentially the boundary state explicitly, and you can compute these partition functions directly, and you find this nice formula here, that in particular, so this is trace of rho to the n, the quantity tau here, which is of course the modular parameter, here is 2 tau is IL over L, the way I define things. And this depends on the theta functions and the derivative function here too. So in the limit, where so here R is the compactification radius. So notice it appears in this particular form out in front. And therefore the piece that essentially is left, in the, so if I take the limit where the modular parameter is large and imaginary, which is the limit where this ratio is very big, essentially the, everything that is inside here goes to 1 in that limit. And then you obtain the formula I derived before. So the dependence in n is present, but it's all subleading. And it turns out that if you look at the subleading term, the first contribution you get here turns out to be the character of the identity representation. So actually this smells a little bit like this conjecture of by Haldane and Lise, and I was doing, I forgot the name, that they conjecture that in the context of the quantum Hall wave functions, that if you actually compute the, in that case they were looking at the analog, it would be the large n, little n limit in that case, and they conjectured that there was a universal piece there that was determined by the CFT, and Haldane, being smart that he is, just by looking at the tower of states he had there, he recognized the, essentially the character of the associated with the various towers that you have in the conformal field theory. Now, how he did that is a mystery to me, but it's true. And in this particular case, it's also true. It appears is a leading contribution, a finite size contribution to this. So these are terms of scale, essentially become very small as L over L goes to infinity. So they are not finite in that limit, but they are associated with the finite size contributions of this. So that's how they enter in this particular wave function. Mm-hmm. So these scale invariant wave functions have, in this sense, a number of interesting properties, and so you learn essentially how to compute essentially the finite contributions, universal contributions to the entanglement entropy, at least in this class. Let me tell you quickly about the case, how to do this in Chern-Simons. I'll do this very quickly, we'll just simply tell you answers. So what I'm going to do, so the idea here is a much borrowing from work that many people have done, particularly Shagan Wen, who's here. The effective field theory of the fractional quantum Hall states is usually some combination of Chern-Simons actions for various gauge fields that you end up deriving. I'm not going to go into why that is the case. And so one way you can ask the question, what is the entanglement entropy for a quantum Hall fluid, is to ask what is the entanglement entropy for the associated effective field theory. And so that's what we did with Rob Lee and two of his students. And it turns out you can solve this problem by using methods that essentially Witten used to solve this problem, for which he got the Fields Medal. So you can use surgeries and so on to actually compute the entanglement entropy. The way you do it is you compute the trace of the density matrix to the nth power in using the path integral directly. And because the theory is topological, you don't get any of the singular non-universal terms that have been regularized to zero, even though they are mostly, they are the biggest terms in town. They disappeared from here. So you end up with some results that they are, I want to tell you the answers, which is more interesting than actually writing it down. So the main result you need to know from Witten is that the partition function of Chern-Simons, say on S3, depends in principle of the state of that you associate with some Wilson loop, and this is some representation associated with some Wilson loop that you have there, and this actually gives you this particular matrix element of the modular S matrix of the theory. So this is the quantity that will appear in a moment. So let me skip all of these details, but let me tell you what the final answer is. So you can compute the trace of rho n to the n, again suitably normalized, and if you do that for a simply connected region, it doesn't matter what the overall manifold looks like, It's simply related to the 0,0 component of the non-Lorentz matrix to the power 1 minus n, with no corrections in this case. And this quantity is precisely the inverse of the effective quantum dimension. That's the result that Levin and Wein and Kitaev and Preston derived. So in this particular case, if you have some simply connected region, you end up precisely with this result directly from Chern-Simons. That's not surprising, since all they assumed was that the theory is topological, okay? So it has to reproduce this. But notice that this result is independent of what state. Suppose you do this for a system on a torus and you observe only some simply connected region. The torus may be in some complicated state of the many states that it could have. The answer is independent of that state if you observe a simply connected region. On the other hand, if you now go to a more complicated geometry, suppose you are in a torus and you cut it this way, much like what we did before, or you can observe some region A, which is separate from region B, which in some sense will be simply connected, then it turns out that in this particular case, if there is no Wilson loop present running around the torus, you just simply get twice the log of this quantity as 0,0. But in this particular case, if there is some non-trivial Wilson loop thread in this region, then the result depends on the particular state in which you are. And so in particular, you end up with, again, a factor of two because there are two surfaces, as in the other case we discussed before, but this goes like the log of one of the off-diagonal matrix elements of the modular S matrix. And therefore, it depends not only on the quantum dimension, or the effective quantum dimension, but also on the quantum dimension of the quasi-particle associated with that particular state. So in general, you can actually go and do more calculations like that by considering different regions with different topologies or maybe with punctures corresponding to various excitations. And then you find that in general, the entanglement entropy depends on the full structure of the topological field theory and not just on a single topological invariant. So given a topological field theory, in principle, I can find a particular measurement of the entropy that will tell me what the associated observable looks like. Now, you could ask a reverse problem. Is there a minimum number of entanglement entropy measurements that I have to make to determine the structure of the topological field theory? Well, that's a hard problem. If I knew the answer, I would have a classification of topological field theories, which is an unsolved problem. And I will leave that as a homework for today.
Okay. Questions? Can you see what happens if you pinch this? I mean, you put a singularity in the surface? Can you see that?
I don't know how to do that within the context of surgeries. In principle, well, if you put the singularity, I know what you're asking.
I want to flow between different critical points. But
well, what you can see, you can compute this, the different entropies you get if you have a system where you
open. No, I don't want to do the two separate ones.
I don't know what happens
when you take one and pinch it.
No, okay. I don't know how to do that. In fact, this was partly motivated by your work with Chaitan and Matthew. But just as you did, we can only figure out what the endpoints are. What happens in between, I don't think one knows how to do this in the context of Chern-Simons theory. Maybe possible by doing that in terms of the edge terms. But I don't think it's simple in the context of Chern-Simons theory.
In the context of streamlet models or quantum double models, we recently found that all the Rényi entropies are the same, basically they give you the same information and just the entanglement. In particular, for the quantum double models, the entanglement spectrum is flat.
Yes.
Does it mean that for this class, that for the topological theories that refer to these models, okay, then there is also it's the same?
In a sense, I think that agrees with this result.
So in that case, there would be no entropy measurement that could distinguish any further the structure of the theory.
As you can see in this particular, precisely because you study systems of the same sort. So this is essentially that the dependence is only in the thermodynamic limit depends simply on the power of a number, which is this number here. And all the Rennie entropies essentially give you the same contribution. So it appears in the subleading terms. So the subleading terms do have some information that is actually not present in the full thermodynamic. Well, all of this is in the thermodynamic limit. The question is, how big is the system under observation relative to the overall system? If I take the limit where the length of my cylinder is much bigger than the circumference, then you obtain precisely the same result at this point. And that is with me.
Okay, let's do this again.